Piazza.
Happy Halloween, Homo detto Halloweeno. Welcome to the Halloween version of Beyond the Ghetto, Within the Village. And this week I have two scary passages to read for you. One is a classic by the late Oscar Wilde called The Picture of Dorian Gray, his only novel, and I'm going to read you a section of that. And I'm also going to read you a section of the late J.B. Laws' novel, Steam, which was his only novel, and one of the scariest novels I have ever read in my entire life as far as gay horror. One modern, one classic. So please, if you dare, come with us beyond the ghetto and hide and cuddle within the village as I read to you on Halloween week. So the first excerpt I'm going to read you, and I love reading for people, is from the novel The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. And this is the unedited version that came out before. Oscar Wilde did two versions of this. Basically, he did an unedited version, which got him in trouble later in the courtroom trials. The prosecutor was trying to use the novel to prove that Oscar Wilde was indeed a homosexual and accordingly committed sodomy against the young men who had complained against him and had him in court. And Oscar Wilde argued that his novel was completely an aesthetic, and that art was aesthetic and art did not reflect reality, and therefore the novel did not reflect the reality of his life. I'm really simplifying his arguments of the time. But he was an aesthete, and he didn't believe that art actually reflected life, and that art therefore did not have any moral comment to make about society. But if you read this great Victorian classic, you wonder how he could have maintained that, because it seems like this entire novel is a judgment about closeted homosexuality, or even homosexuality, and the evils of drug abuse, and it almost sounds like a moralistic cautionary tale. But Oscar Wilde insists that it is only a story and was never meant to be a cautionary tale. So there it is. And here is an excerpt from Chapter 11, The Picture of Dorian Gray. He passed out of the room and began the ascent, Basil Hallward following close behind. They walked softly, as men instinctively do at night. The lamp cast fantastic shadows on the wall and staircase. A rising wind made some of the windows rattle. When they reached the top landing, Dorian set the lamp down on the floor and, taking out the key, turned it in the lock. "You insist on knowing, Basil?" he asked in a low voice. "Yes, I am delighted," he murmured, smiling. Then he added, somewhat bitterly, "You are the one man in the world who's entitled to know everything about me. You've had more to do with my life than you think." And taking up the lamp, he opened the door and went in. A cold current of air passed them, and the light shot up for a moment in a flame of murky orange. He shuddered. "Shut the door behind you," he said, as he placed the lamp on the table. Hallward glanced around him with a puzzled expression. The room looked as if it had not been lived in for years. A faded Flemish tapestry, a curtain picture, an old Italian cassone, an almost empty bookcase. That was all it seemed to contain besides a chair and a table. As Dorian Gray was lighting a half-burned candle that was standing on the mantel shelf, he saw that the whole place was covered with dust, and the carpet was in holes. A mouse ran scuffling behind the wainscoting. There was a damp odor of mildew. "So you think that it is only God who sees the soul, Basil? Draw that curtain back and you will see mine." The voice that spoke was cold and cruel. "You are mad, Dorian, or you are playing a part," muttered Hallward, frowning. "You won't? Then I must do it myself," said the young man, and he tore the curtain from its rod and flung it to the ground. An exclamation of horror broke from Hallward's lips as he saw in the dim light the hideous thing on the canvas leering at him. There was something in its expression that filled him with disgust and loathing. Good heavens, it was Dorian Gray's own face that he was looking at. The horror, whatever it was, had not yet entirely marred that marvelous beauty. There was still some gold in the thinning hair and some scarlet on the sensual lips. The sodden eyes had kept something of the loveliness of their blue, noble curves, had not yet passed entirely away from the chiseled nostrils and from plastic throat. Yes, it was Dorian himself. But who had done it? He seemed to recognize his own brushwork. The frame was his own design. The idea was monstrous, yet he felt afraid. He seized the lighted candle and held it to the picture. In the left-hand corner was his own name, traced in long letters of bright vermilion. It was some foul parody, some infamous, ignoble satire. He had never done that. Still, it was his own picture. He knew it, and he felt as if his blood had changed from fire to sluggish ice in a moment. His own picture! What did it mean? Why had it altered? He turned and looked at Dorian Gray with the eyes of a sick man. His mouth twitched and his parched tongue seemed unable to articulate. He passed his hand across his forehead. It was damp, dank with clammy sweat. The young man was leaning against the mantel shelf, watching him with that strange expression that is on the faces of those who are absorbed in a play when a great artist is acting. There was neither real sorrow in it, nor real joy. There was simply the passion of the spectator, with perhaps a flicker of triumph in the eyes. He had taken the flower out of his coat and was smelling it, or pretending to do so. "What does this mean?" cried Howard at last. His own voice sounded shrill and furious in his ears. "Years ago, when I was a boy," said Dorian Gray, "you met me, devoted yourself to me, flattered me, and taught me to be vain of my good looks. One day you introduced me to a friend of yours who explained to me the wonder of youth, and you finished a portrait of me that revealed to me the wonder of beauty. In a mad moment, that I don't know, even now whether I regret it or not, I made a wish. Perhaps you should call it a prayer." "I remember it! Oh, how well I remember it! No, the thing is impossible. The room is damp. The mildew has got into the canvas. The paints I used, some wretched mineral poison in them. I tell you, this thing is impossible." "Ah, what is impossible?" murmured the young man, going over to the window and leaning his forehead against the cold, mist-stained glass. "You told me you had destroyed it." "I was wrong. It has destroyed me." "I don't believe it is my picture." "Can't you see your romance in it?" said Dorian bitterly. "My romance, as you call it." "As you called it." "There was nothing evil in it, nothing shameful. This is the face of a satyr. It is the face of my soul. God, what a thing I must have worshipped. This has the eyes of the devil." "Each of us has heaven and hell in him, Basil," cried Dorian, with a wild gesture of despair. Hallward turned to the portrait and gazed at it. "My God, if it's true," he exclaimed, "and this is what you have done with your life, why, you must be worse than those who talk against you, who fancy you to be." He held the light up again to the canvas and examined it. The surface seemed quite undisturbed, and as he had left it. It was from within, apparently, that the foulness and the horror had come. Though some strange quickening of inner life, the leprosies of sin, were slowly eating the thing away, the rotting of a corpse in a watery grave was not so fearful. His hand shook, and the candle fell from its socket onto the floor and lay there sputtering. He placed his foot on it and put it out. Then he flung himself to the rickety chair that was standing by the table and buried his face in his hands. "Good God, Dorian, what a lesson! What an awful lesson!" There was no answer. He could hear the young man sobbing at the window. "Pray, Dorian, pray," he murmured. "What is it that one was taught to say in one's boyhood? Lead us not into temptation. Forgive us our sins. Wash away our iniquities." Let us say that together. The prayer of your pride has been answered. The prayer of your repentance will be answered also. I worshipped you too much. I am punished for it. You worshipped yourself too much. We are both punished. Dorian Gray turned slowly around and looked at him with the tear-dimmed eyes. It's too late, Basil, he murmured. "It is never too late, Dorian. Let us kneel down and try it if we can to remember a prayer. Isn't there a verse somewhere? Though your sins are scarlet, I will make them white as snow." Those words mean nothing to me now. "Hush! Don't say that. You have done enough evil in your life. My God, don't you see this accursed thing leering at us?" Dorian Gray glanced at the picture and suddenly an uncontrollable feeling of hatred for Basil Hallward came over him. The mad passions of a hunted animal stirred within him, and he loathed the man who was seated at the table more than he had ever loathed anything in his life. He glanced wildly around. Something glimmered on the top of the painted chest that faced him. His eye fell on it. He knew what it was. It was a knife that he had brought up some days before to cut a piece of cord and had forgotten to take away with him. He moved slowly toward it, passing Hallward as he did so. As soon as he got behind him, he seized it and turned around. Hallward moved in his chair as if he was going to rise. He rushed at him and dug the knife in the great vein that is behind the ear, crushing the man's head down on the table and stabbing it again and again and again. There was a stifled moan and the horrible sound of someone choking with blood. The outstretched arm shot up convulsively three times, waving grotesque stiff fingers hands in the air. He stabbed at him once more, but the man did not move. Something began to trickle on the floor. He waited for a moment, still pressing the head down. Then he threw the knife on the table and listened. He could hear nothing but the drip, drip, drip on the threadbare carpet. He opened the door and went out on the landing. The house was quite quiet. No one was stirring. He took out the key and returned to the room, locking himself in as he did so. The thing was still seated in the chair, straining over the table with bowed head and humped back and long, fantastic arms. Had it not been for the red, jagged tear in the neck and the clotted black pool that slowly widened on the table, one should have said that the man was simply asleep. How quickly it had all been done! How strangely he felt strangely calm, and walking over to the window, opened it and stepped out of the balcony. The wind had blown the fog away, and the sky was like a monstrous peacock's tail, starred with myriads of golden eyes. He looked down and saw the policeman doing his rounds and flashing a bull's-eye lantern on the doors of the silent houses. The crimson spot of a prowling hansom gleamed at the corner and then vanished. A woman in a ragged shawl was creeping around the building, staggering as she went. Now and then she stopped and peered back. Once she began to sing in a hoarse voice. The policeman strolled over and said something to her. She stumbled away, laughing. A bitter blast swept across the square. The gas lamps flickered and became blue, and the leafless trees shook their black iron branches as if in pain. Dorian shivered and went back, closing the window behind him. J.B. Laws, who was a writer in the 80s and sadly passed away of AIDS, wrote one of the scariest, most horrifying gay novels ever to be written, in my opinion, in English. He was a San Francisco playwright and writer. His work appeared in the New York Times, the New York Native, the Castro Times, the Advocate Men, and Torso, and he won the 1986 Actors Alley Repertory Grand Prize for a play, A Night for Colored Glass. Steam is his first novel, and I believe that it was his only novel before he became sick and passed away. Richard Labonte of A Different Light Bookstores wrote this review: Steam is the perfect horror tale, too scary to pick up, too gripping to put down. J. Laws has taken the genre of psychological chiller and twisted it into a truly queer adventure. Let me tell you that this book is so scary that if you're up reading it late at night and you hear a bang on the window, you will go right through the ceiling. This is a scary novel, and I'm going to read you a caption of it. But let me just give you an overview. The name of the novel is Steam. It's hard to get. It was published in it's copywritten 1991, so it was published posthumously. I think he was writing it in the 80s. It's about, basically, a haunted steam bath, and that may sound a little bit trite. And you're thinking, oh, haunted steam bath, how sexual. Well, there are spirits in this closed, haunted steam bath of folks who are dead. Not necessarily of AIDS, but there is a doppelganger in here that has to do with AIDS infection. But basically, there's a demon that lives in the steam that causes people to be attracted to this bathhouse where they are basically consumed and entombed and entrapped forever. And they're drawn by basically succubuses, gay succubi, who are attracting people sexually, both straight and gay, and even folks who are just entering puberty. and the succubi can come all through San Francisco. And San Francisco can be an eerie, foggy town at times. So this is a passage from the novel Steam. Get some hot chocolate and be prepared to be a little spooked.
Oh, I've been watching you. You use the phone like a hard dick in your hand. Call strange men and whisper to them. You stroke yourself while you talk, am I right? Aren't you in bed right now, touching yourself?
Maybe I am.
I am. I'm tugging on my balls right now, wishing it was your hand grabbing me. How about joining in?
Sure. What do you look like?
I'm blonde like you, blue eyes, 5'10". Brown hair all over my chest, a line of it running down to my dick, thighs and legs furry with it.
Jesus, we could be twins.
That's why I've watched you. I know you have a secret fantasy of playing with men who mirror you.
Wait a minute, nobody knows about that, nobody.
I am your twin, Joey. We're so handsome together, don't you think? Let's pull our dicks, run our tongues over each other's nipples, finger each other's sweet assholes. Uh-huh.
Oh, talk to me, whoever you are.
I know of a palace, Joey. I want to take you there. I'll lead you into a mirrored room where you'll strip out of your clothes. You'll show off for me, won't you?
Sure, you bet.
And when you're completely naked, you will lean over and wait for me, hand upon your manhood, waiting for my command.
God, I wish you were here.
You do?
I want to see you. I want to touch you.
Let me hear you work yourself, Joey. Let me hear you. Faster. You really want to see me?
Yes.
Look out your window.
And Joey, a likable guy with years of living ahead of him, a man surrounded by loving friends and supportive family, a man who watches his health like a hawk and who planned to live to a ripe old age, glances away from his erection and out of his bedroom window and screams at the grinning devil face pressed against the glass. The creature holds a telephone receiver to his ear, the wire cord a dangling chewed-off end. Joey hears it chuckle through the phone receiver, a sound as old and as jagged as Arctic moonlight. An explosion of glass and fury as the creature falls upon him and takes its communion meal. I hope you enjoyed the Halloween special that we put on for you this evening. The wonderful music track, which I manipulated a bit with apologies, is by Matthew Presidente from his song Halloween, which you'll hear in its entirety in just a moment. It's from his new CD, Buckle Up, Matty P. And if you go to the video cast, you will see him playing at Numbers live in a couple of days if it isn't up quite yet.
And I'd like to wish you a happy Halloween from beyond the ghetto.
You're listening to RadioGay.ca.
She got a new adventure on the horizon. I've got a lot to send, but my packaging is poor. She got a brand new costume, and this Halloween I'm out. I just can't.